Well, I think I have said the Bible is the biggest selling book in history. 6 billion copies in total and climbing. It's the biggest selling book every single year that we have records for, except for the year 2007, as I explained. And therefore, one a second. One Bible a second. In the time that we've known each other, what's that? An hour and a half? 4,500 Bibles have sold. Just in the time of the last 90 minutes. The reason for it, I suggest, is that despite much skepticism in our day, especially in Australia, and my Scandinavian friends these last 2 weeks have told me here in Scandinavia as well, despite the skepticism, the Bible has captivating answers to the most profound questions. Why the beauty? What to make of the ugly? Is there a resolution? And how should I live now? These fundamental questions are answered in the Bible in a way that I think draws many people to its story. I started by saying that there is a problem of beauty, just as there is a problem of ugliness. We just don't notice the problem of the beauty as much as we notice the problem of the ugly. And I drew your attention to the analogy of a working tap. We don't notice the working tap as much as the dripping tap. The dripping tap gets our attention. It annoys us. But actually, the working tap is more powerful, more sophisticated, more mysterious. It's only because we expect a tap to work that we notice the brokenness. It's only because we detect the goodness and order in creation that we have a problem of pain and evil. We don't expect disorder and then get surprised when there's some order. In some ways, the very problem of pain and ugliness and disorder only makes sense because we know the order, the elegance, the beauty. I suggested in the last talk that the first theme of the Bible is the goodness of all things, the goodness of God, the goodness of creation, the goodness even of human beings. The second theme, however, is the dripping tap, is the brokenness, the ugliness. Let me read to you from the Evening News of India, Tuesday, October 12, years ago. All 89 passengers and 6 crew members were killed when an Indian Airlines plane bound for Madras crashed within minutes of takeoff at Santa Cruz Airport at 1:40 a.m. today. The plane was only some 3 minutes airborne when its pilot noticed a fire in one of the engines. He was reported to have told air traffic control of the fire and said, "I'm coming back." Eyewitnesses, including friends and relatives who had come to see the passengers off, saw the plane burning in the night sky like a red ball before it crashed. The passengers had no chance. I remember that night like it was yesterday, watching the TV with my brothers. We received a phone call to learn that my father was on that plane and he was gone. I was 9. I remember that night well, but I don't remember the weeks after it, actually. But my mum tells me that a few days after the plane crash, I approached her and I said, "Why did God let Dad's plane crash?" That sounds like an ordinary and obvious question. But the thing is, my family never talked about God. Never. Not once. I had never been inside a church. We never said grace before a meal. But even a completely secular Australian 9-year-old can recognize the ugliness and knows the right question to ask. Why? I suppose that was the first day I really noticed the dripping tap. I noticed that things actually generally work. There is a general beauty and goodness. And yet it all came literally crashing down that day. But here is one of the Bible's most beautifully inviting dimensions. It's one I didn't know back then. I only became a Christian at 16 years of age. I didn't know that actually the Bible invites us to ask this question. The Bible isn't shy about us crying out to the Almighty, "Why?" And "What are you going to do about it?" And "Where are you in the midst of it?" The Bible invites our questioning and doubts. If you're a Christian and you are used to this, it's hard to see how puzzling it is that the Bible actually gives us words to cry out at God about the ugliness. This is not the case in Hinduism, where every bad event is the result of karma, the doctrine of payback. It's not the case in Buddhism, which teaches that you must rise above all feelings of pain by detaching from the world. And even amongst our Muslim friends, to cry out, "Why, God?" is to risk insulting the Almighty. But in the biblical tradition, you can cry out to God. This is a precious gift. We don't only have to call out Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not be in want. He makes me lie down in green pastures." I assume that is a very famous psalm here as well as where I come from. But of course, what's the psalm immediately before the famous Psalm 23? Yes, I know it's Psalm 22. But do you remember how it goes? My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me? So far from my cries of anguish? My God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer. By night, but I find no rest. These are God's words given to human beings to cry out to Him. the Psalms of lament, the Psalms of complaint, are about one-fifth of the Psalms. Amazing. About 30 Psalms are there for you to complain to God. Sometimes Christians get it into their heads, they're only allowed to say, the Lord is my shepherd, the Lord is my shepherd, the Lord is my shepherd, the Lord is my shepherd. And forget that sometimes the cry, why? Where are you? Is just as much a cry of faith as the affirmation, the Lord is my shepherd. The Bible is brutally honest about the ugliness, is what I'm saying. And it's the second theme of the Bible. It's not the first, because you need to understand the working tap before you get the dripping tap. I know this analogy is going to run out sometime soon. But it is the second theme, the theme of the fall of everything. The Lord God commanded the man, you are free to eat from the tree in the garden, from any tree, but you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat from it, you will certainly die. When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. To Adam the Lord said, because you ate from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. Very early on in the Bible, we confront the ugliness. There's no hiding. The human heart is fallen. The ground is cursed. And Genesis 2 and 3 offer an extraordinary literary device to emphasize this theme. As much as our culture wants to avoid the doctrine of sin, as much as Christians in the West are embarrassed about our doctrine of sin, Genesis 2 and 3 are designed so that you will not miss the doctrine of sin. How so? It uses a giant, I'm not sure how this will translate into Finnish, but here we go, palistrophe or chiasm. You can forget the words as soon as you hear them. But this is a literary device where the first scene of a story corresponds to the last scene of a story. The second scene of a story corresponds to the second last. The third scene of a story to the third last. The middle scene has no parallel and tells you the point of the story. This is one of the many biblical examples of literary genius in our scriptures. And Genesis 2 and 3 is designed so that there is an A, B, C, D, C, B, A. And the central scene is, you guessed it, Adam and Eve disobeying God and eating. One of the great biblical scholars in his two-volume commentary on Genesis, Gordon Wenham, writes, the whole narrative is therefore a masterpiece of palistrophic writing. the mirror image style. A, B, C, D, C, B, A. Not only does the literary structure move in and out in this fashion, but so does the action. It commences outside the garden, the dialogues are conducted within the garden, and the decisive act of disobedience takes place at its very center. And then it moves out again. You may think that's the sort of thing that should stay in theological seminary, in the universities. We don't need this. But actually, I'm of the view that if our authors have put these beautiful designs into the scriptures, there is always going to be some value in spotting it. And I think in this case, there is a very important reason. Genesis 2 and 3 do not want you to miss the centrality of our doctrine of sin, of the fallenness of the human heart. What is the tree of knowledge of good and evil? This is one of those things that often misunderstood. The tree of knowledge of good and evil cannot mean merely discerning good and evil, merely understanding good and evil. The whole story assumes that Adam knows the difference between obeying God and not obeying God. So it can't mean what we think initially it means. He knows in advance, I am not meant to do this, I am permitted to do this. Yeah? So that can't mean that. What does it mean? I am persuaded by those scholars who point out that the key to understanding this idea of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is understanding the flexibility of the Hebrew word to know, the knowledge. Yada means to understand, sometimes. It means to experience. It means to choose. It means to determine. It even means to have sex. Did you know that? Some of you did. In the traditional English translations, or the old English translations, it would say, instead of they made love or something, it would say, and he knew her. It's the same in Swedish. What about Finnish? Does Finnish? Yeah. Okay, so already we understand this word yada means a range of things. By the way, I think the Star Wars figure Yoda comes from yada. I think that's actually meant to be a play on this idea of knowledge. You don't need to know that. That is just for free this morning. Yada, in this context, probably means something like choose or determine. In other words, eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil indicates Adam's decision to know good and evil by his personal judgment rather than by listening to the Creator. That makes sense of the passage. And of course, you can see why that would be the height of folly, a terrible turning from the Lord. Adam was given responsibility over God's creation as God's image. And of course, he was to depend on the knowledge of God for the knowledge of good and evil. Or he could choose to determine good and evil for himself. And as a result of all of this, the Bible says the creation itself is fallen. Do you notice up there in that first paragraph in chapter 2, it says, if you eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will certainly die. See how it says that? For when you eat from it, you will certainly die. It's even stronger in the original language because it says, on the day you eat, you will certainly die. Okay. But what happens when they eat? They don't die. They don't drop dead. They go on and on and on and on to live. They have children. To die in this scene doesn't mean merely for the body to die. We have to notice what happens on the day they eat it. Three things. Adam and Eve become disconnected from one another. Yeah? They blame each other. She made me do it. He made me do it. Secondly, they're estranged from the very earth itself. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will work the ground. And the third, they are distant from God. Humanity made in God's image are now hiding from God in the garden. The death that Genesis speaks of is not physical death. It is the breakdown of the social, creational, and spiritual dimensions of our life. True death. And although there are many philosophical questions we might want to ask of this passage, the overall point is that the Bible is completely open and honest about the fallenness of things, about the ugliness in things. And it asks the descendants of Adam to know that they too are Adam. We are all Adam. We choose to determine good and evil. We refuse to love God with all our heart, love our neighbor as ourselves. We are fallen. And this has had catastrophic effects. Much more can and should be said about the fallenness of creation. And I'll say a little bit more about it later on. But I want to focus on what Genesis 2 and 3 focus on. Us. The design of this whole passage is to put us in the spotlight. We are Adam. We turn away from the Lord. Now, I know that the doctrine of human fallenness has been abused by the church through history. Sometimes churches have preached the fall of humanity, the sinfulness of humanity, with almost a smile on the face, and have turned people right off the whole doctrine of sin. And I do fear that modern Western Christians themselves don't like thinking about the doctrine of sin. It makes us unpopular. We'd much rather talk about Christianity as the fulfillment of your life. And we can make an argument along those lines. Of course, if we are creatures made in the image of God, our very self, our very flourishing can only be achieved by connecting back to God. The problem is, if we avoid our doctrine of sin, we don't lay the emphasis on the problem that the Bible insists upon. And therefore, we diminish the solution that the Scriptures insist upon. Jesus' death on a cross only makes sense if we have a robust doctrine of sin. Only if we understand Genesis 3 can we understand the gospel. There is something utterly compelling about the Bible's insistence on our fallenness. And I want to offer you two examples of the power of knowing our own fallenness. First, it helps me understand myself. Every human being, in their honest moments, instinctively values him or herself and wants to be valued by others. And our doctrine of creation gives us that. And every human being in their most honest moments knows that we hardly live up to our own expectations, let alone the expectations of those around us, let alone the expectations of the Creator. In our honest moments, we know our fallenness. I would hate to live by the secular myth that I am good through and through and only getting better. This idea, which really was popularized in the Enlightenment, which removed all this nasty stuff about sin and fallenness, yuck, that belongs with the Dark Ages. The Enlightenment so valued human intelligence and goodness and developed this idea that humans are at least neutral, a blank slate, or positively good. And that the force of history is making us all better and better and better. Yeah. I want to say I would hate to believe that. Many of our secular friends believe it. I think it is a crushing doctrine. Because how could I cope with the counter evidence every day in my life? By 9 a.m., I know I'm not good through and through and only getting better. Imagine I had to maintain my inherent goodness and live with me. Crushing. Deluded. The Bible actually, in insisting on our fallenness, helps us to know ourselves. It is our true identity that we are made in the image of God and have defied God. This doctrine helps me to know myself, but I want to go beyond that and offer you a second thought. The Bible's doctrine of human fallenness and ugliness provides a healthy corrective to religion. And this is helpful to point out to our skeptical friends. See, the Bible doesn't say the world's really fallen, but Christians, they're good through and through and only getting better. The Bible doesn't teach that, right? The Bible teaches that sometimes the people of God are the worst of the lot. In fact, there's every reason to think that the way the Genesis story is shaped is designed also to recall the history of Israel, what will happen in Israel. If you think of Adam not just as Adam, not just as our representative, but as representing Israel, it's really interesting. Israel is given a law. Israel is placed in a land, a garden. Israel disobeys the law. Israel is expelled from the land. Yeah? We see Israel's story in Adam's story. And I think readers are meant to see the religious heart, not just the irreligious heart here. Because one of the, I think, beautiful things about the Bible is it is probably, of all the documents of ancient history, the most critical of its own people. The most scathing of its greatest heroes. Yeah? We are used to this. We're used to reading, you know, the terrible sins that the Israelites got up to in the book of Judges. And we go, oh, you know, that's hypocrites. Or we turn to Adam, David, King David, the great king who murders and commits adultery. We're used to this, but it is astonishing in ancient literature to find such a moral critique of the greatest people. And it's true in the New Testament as well. Just when you think Peter is this glorious follower of Jesus, he denies Jesus 3 times. Some of the most despicable stories in the Old Testament are there to remind us that God's people are fallen. Do you know that terrible story in Judges 19? The one you never want to read out in church services. If you're on the roster for reading, you don't want to read this one. It's one of those passages you don't want to read your children. A Levite who's meant to be a special, almost priestly person has a concubine. That right there is a little bit problematic. And he offers his concubine to a crowd that wants to do its best with her. And he leaves her for dead. And then, of course, he sends her body parts to the 12 tribes of Israel. You know the story, right? If you haven't read it recently, I understand completely. But Richard Dawkins, the world's most famous atheist, in his book, The God Delusion, tells this horrible story and then says, see, that's biblical morality. Really? That's what the Bible advocates. Every reader of the book of Judges knows that story is there to tell us how bad God's people can get. I went to the spot where this terrible story is set and filmed a little scene
In the book of Judges, we're told of a traveling Levite, a religious leader, and his concubine. They spent the night at Gibeah, a village that once stood on this hill, just north of Jerusalem. According to the Bible, the townsfolk beat on the door of the house in the middle of the night, demanding entertainment. The Levite threw out his young woman to satisfy the mob, and they did what they wanted to her and left her for dead.
It gets worse. The Levite picks her up, throws her on his donkey, and when she doesn't wake up, he gets out his knife and, well, he sends her body parts to the 12 regions of Israel as a rallying cry against the people of Gibeah. The Israelite armies gather on the hill of Mizpah over there, and civil war breaks out, with thousands more being killed. The whole story is sickening in its violence.
But what is a story like this doing in the Bible? As any reader of the book of Judges will discover, it's not there as a moral example, but the opposite. This and many stories like it are designed to show us just how bad God's own people had become in this period.
I don't know any other national history that so freely tells us about the decadence, violence, and injustice of its own people, sometimes its own heroes. Exposing religious hypocrisy might feel like a very modern thing, but actually it begins in the Jewish scriptures or Old Testament. Story after story reminds us that sometimes the chosen people are the worst of the lot.
Criticizing hypocrisy is often thought to be a secular pastime, habit. But actually, it's a biblical tradition. Criticizing religious fallenness, just as much as any other fallenness out there, is what our doctrine of sin must do. It completely removes the judgmentalism that we so often find in the church. You know how, well, maybe it's not the case here, I can't tell, but where I come from and many other countries I've visited, Christians have a reputation for judging, condemning other people. It's not true in Finland, right? No. It is true, no. But actually, our doctrine of sin ought to remove this. And this is a point brought forward beautifully by this man, Francis Spufford, who until recently was an atheist intellectual in London. And then he accidentally became an Anglican, even a Christian Anglican. I speak as an Anglican, so I'm allowed to say that. And one of the key points that led him to consider Christianity was the realization that his secular, intellectual, social set were just as judgmental as anything he'd seen in churches. In fact, more. It dawned on him that at their dinner parties, they would be criticizing and judging conservatives, religious people, as if they were superior and wonderful. And then it dawned on him, Christians actually have in their resources, in their doctrines, the end of judgmentalism, in a way that his secular social set could never have, because his secular set believed we are good through and through and only getting better. Therefore, the problem with those rotten conservatives and church folk is that they are lower down the rung. They are lower than me. But it dawned on him that Christians believe we're all sinful. Therefore, we can't judge one another. And he wrote a book called Unapologetic, where he describes his conversion to Christianity. And here is how he describes this theme of judgmentalism in the church. So of all things, Christianity isn't supposed to be about gathering up the good people, shiny, happy, squeaky clean, and excluding the bad people, frightening, alien, repulsive, for the very simple reason that there aren't any good people. Not that can be securely designated as such. Christianity can't be about circling the wagons of virtue out in the suburbs and keeping the unruly inner city at bay. This, I realize, goes flat contrary to the present predominant image of Christianity as something existing in prissy, fastidious little enclaves. That's going to be hard to translate. Far from life's messier zones and inclined to get all judgmental about them. There are Christians like that, he says. The religion certainly can slip into being a club or a cozy affinity group or a wall against the world. But it isn't supposed to be. What it's supposed to be is a league of the guilty. Not all guilty of the same things or in the same way, but enough for us to recognize each other. And this was one of the key things that brought this staunch intellectual atheist to embrace Christ. The news that he was fallen. And we are all fallen. Friends, don't shy away from our doctrine of sin. It is true, and I think it is powerful. It explains me to myself. And it provides a corrective to hypocritical, judgmental religion. Okay, I've forgotten when I'm meant to finish, so I need to fancy work out how... 12:15. Okay. Cool. I've spent a long time on our fallenness. But I want to pivot to what the Bible says about the resolution to the fallenness, to the ugliness. There are two immediate questions confronting anyone faced with the beauty and the ugliness. Question one, why exactly am I suffering? Question two, how will it resolve? Why exactly am I suffering? How will it resolve? Now, the Bible is a little bit shy giving a complete answer to the first question. Why am I suffering in any particular moment? But the Bible has an extraordinary answer to the second question. What is the resolution? And I suggest that if you were only allowed one answer to those questions, you'd choose the second. See, imagine being able to know why you are suffering and not knowing if there's any resolution. But if you know there's a resolution, you can cope with not knowing why. You can put one foot in front of the other, knowing that the dawn is breaking. The Bible offers an extraordinary account of resolution. And I want to illustrate the Bible's teaching before exactly explaining it. Some of you may know this name, Wynton Marsalis. He is regarded by many as the greatest living trumpeter. I don't say that as a, you know, he's not Australian, so I'm not showing off. He's American. And if there's a great Finnish trumpeter, I apologize. But this one is regarded as, by many, as the greatest living trumpeter. And the Atlantic Monthly, back in 2003, told an amazing true story of when Wynton Marsalis turned up at a little jazz bar in New York, incognito, with a hat and dark sunglasses, so no one would recognize him. Because he was normally playing in big concert halls, and he just wanted to play with some friends in a little venue smaller than this one. Just 30 people, 40 people maybe. They had no idea who this trumpeter was. But in the back was a music journalist who ended up writing this piece. And he said that Wynton Marsalis, he couldn't quite work out who it was until the fourth song of the night, when the trumpeter played an amazing ballad, and then he knew exactly who he was listening to. Here's a little taste of Wynton Marsalis, by the way. And then right in the middle of the ballad, someone's mobile phone went off in the front row. Loud as anything. And Wynton Marsalis just stopped playing. And the room started laughing. And the person in the front row took the phone call. Hello? Everyone started just going back to talk with one another, and the journalist said Wynton Marsalis just stood frozen at the microphone, not knowing what to do. And the journalist said he wrote on his little notepad, "Magic ruined. Magic ruined." A few moments went by. No one was looking at stage. And Wynton Marsalis started to play again. The mobile phone tune that he'd just heard. He started playing. Right? Just from what he'd heard. And people started to laugh and give their attention to him. And then he started to improvise on the tune and slow it down. But listen to the way the journalist describes it. Then he repeated it and began improvising variations on the tune. The audience slowly came back to him. In a few minutes, he resolved the improvisation, which had changed keys once or twice and throttled down to a ballad tempo and ended up exactly where he had left off. The ovation was tremendous. Wouldn't you love to have been there for that moment? Here's my point. The Bible says that God, the great maestro, will weave all of the false and corrupting melodies of our world back into his eternal melody. God will resolve the discord in a way none of us can really comprehend, but he will bring it to a completion, and the ovation will be tremendous. As indeed Revelation 21 says, God himself will be with them, be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain. For the old order of things has passed away. He who is seated on the throne said, I am making everything new. Only at the climax of the Wynton Marsalis story do you know what kind of story it is. Yeah? And for the journalist in the middle of the story, when he experienced it, he didn't know what kind of story he was in. He thought he was in a magic ruined story. But by the end, he looks back and says, I was in a miraculous moment of musical resolution. And although the Bible is not strong on philosophical explanation of the ugliness, it does tell us what kind of story we're in. It tells us that we are headed to new creation, the triumph of justice and love, the redemption of the body, the recreation of all things, the eternal melody, and the resurrection of Jesus in time is the down payment of the future, the deposit of the full payment. The resurrection is the first notes of the new tune, telling us that we're in a story of redemption. And so we can put one foot in front of the other through the sadness, knowing that we are in the hands of the maestro, the master. In my remaining minutes, I want to turn to perhaps the most profound question approaching us as we think about the ugliness. The most practical question for those who are actually suffering, as opposed to those who are doing philosophy, is where is God in my suffering and pain? Where is God in this evil and fallen world? Did he wind up the universe and let it go until a resolution? Where is he? Here's my daughter, Josie. And when she falls over and grazes her knee, she runs to me. And when she gets to me, she doesn't stop and say, Daddy, why the problem of the graze on my knee? Can you explain it to me? No, she runs to me, and all she wants to know is, I've got her. She just wants my embrace. And what I'm saying is that the Bible, in addition to giving us the resolution, says that in the meantime, God is in the midst of the ugliness, himself bearing wounds. The pain of the psalmist, my God, why have you forsaken me, actually became the pain of God incarnate on the cross. As you well know, Mark 15, at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus is not crying a moment of self-doubt. He is deliberately quoting a psalm. He's deliberately quoting a psalm everyone knew. And everyone had been crying for centuries, my God, why have you forsaken me? And of course, on the cross, as I've already said, Jesus atones for our sins. He bears the judgment the world deserves. But even more than that, on the cross, God enters into our pain. God experiences injustice, the betrayal of friends, torture, a final breath. God incarnate has wounds. Anyone who has ever cried, "My God, why?" learns that God himself identifies with our pain. The God of the Bible understands and sympathizes with human pain and anguish and doubt, not just because he is all-knowing, but because he has experienced injustice and pain and death. This vision of God, and I believe this vision of God only, can satisfy the human walking through this ugly world. And you know, it's a point made by one of the greatest atheists of the 20th century. One of the greatest atheists of the 20th century actually knew doctrine better than a lot of Christians, which is kind of sad. Albert Camus, that French existentialist who normally argued that the universe is silent, that there is nothing but a deathly nothing. But in his essay, The Rebel, he reflected on the crucifixion of Jesus. And he said that if this were true, which as an atheist he didn't believe, but if this were true, this would be the answer to human longings and cries. Here's how he put it. Christ came to solve two major problems, evil and death. His solution consisted first in experiencing them. The man God suffers too, with patience. Evil and death can no longer be entirely imputed to him, since he suffers and dies. The night on Golgotha is so important in the history of man only because in its shadow the divinity abandoned its traditional privileges and drank to the last drop, despair included, the agony of death. Don't you love it when an atheist can remind us of the beauty and uniqueness of the Christian faith? It was reported that he had been meeting with a Parisian pastor to study the Gospels. He died, as you probably know, in a car crash in 1960. And rumors emerged afterwards about his meeting with that pastor. And the pastor apparently was very, didn't want to talk about it. So we don't know what happened. We don't know what Albert Camus thought. Maybe Albert Camus was just being a good atheist, wanting to learn the Gospels, wanting to learn what he didn't believe in better. Whatever the case, he puts his finger on the most amazing dimension of the Christian faith, which is a blasphemy in Islam, by the way. I've had many interactions with Muslims, privately and publicly, over the years, and they will happily say that this notion of God having a body, of God being beaten up, of God breathing his last breath, is blasphemous. But to us, of course, it is glorious. The pain of losing my father was worse when I was 18 than when I was 9. Because when I was 9, I just asked that simple question, why? When I was 18, I had become a Christian. And I found myself crying, God, what do you know about my pain? Where were you in the midst of my pain? Because I began to see my friends, who were also 18, become friends with their fathers. And that brought home to me that I didn't have a father in a quite visceral way. And so I had all these doubts and I had all these this anger and these questions. And a dear friend took me aside one day after hearing me complain just a little bit too much. And said, it's okay to cry your complaints, to doubt. It's okay to do all of that, but you must do it looking at the cross. You must do it looking at the cross. Because there you realize the God you bring your complaint to himself has wounds. And you may not be able to trace every line of the artist's image, but you can trust his heart. Some of the work of the Lord in this universe baffles us, but he has revealed himself as willing to die for us. And that helps. I'm aware of the cynical interpretation of all of this. The cynical interpretation is that it's all a wish fulfillment. Sure, Christianity sounds like a beautiful answer, but it's made up to sound like a beautiful answer. Yeah? It's a wish fulfillment. You long for this suffering God, and so you invent a suffering God. You long for a new creation, so you invent a new creation. This, of course, was the claim of Ludwig Feuerbach, the famous philosopher who wrote a book called On Natural Religion, where he explains away religion as a wish fulfillment. And Sigmund Freud, of course, said in a psychological frame, we long for a big parent in the sky, and so we invent a big parent in the sky. You know, it's a common criticism. However, people at the time of Freud quite rightly said, but what about your atheism? Couldn't that be a wish fulfillment too? If our psychological longings are so powerful to produce God, surely our psychological aversion to God is enough to remove God. Maybe your atheism, Herr Professor Freud, is simply the projection of your aversion to your overbearing Austrian father. Some thirsts correspond to real thirst quenchers. It is no argument at all to point out that Christianity satisfies our longings and therefore isn't true. What kind of logic is that? I'm thirsty right now. I'm thirsty right now. So, I got some water. I should have prepared this better. Ooh, I'm thirsty. Imagine saying to me, oh, John, you only believe in water because you're thirsty. There's no actual water, there is just the thirst. But some thirsts correspond to real thirst quenchers. And I am saying as I close, yes, Christianity is a wish fulfillment. It's just a true one. It is water for our thirst. And long before Feuerbach and Freud, St. Augustine said this in the opening lines of one of the most influential books in world history. Man is one of your creatures, Lord, and his instinct is to praise you. The thought of you stirs him so deeply that he cannot be content unless he praises you. Because you made us for yourself, and our hearts find no peace until they rest in you. Christ is the water to our thirst, but he is true water. And so it's not surprising that the final paragraph of the Bible invites us for a drink. Do you remember that? Let the one who is thirsty come. Let the one who wishes take the free gift of the water of life.